Hello and welcome to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. There are exciting things happening in the heavens, space travel, with some big news stories in the last few weeks. Tonight on the show, my co-host Lee Wilkins talks with Angela Speck, who directs astronomy here at the University of Missouri. They'll talk about the New Horizons space probe and also a moon landing achieved by the space program of China. How these were accomplished and why they are important, what we're going to learn from these exciting events. We're out of this world tonight, Thinking Out Loud on KBIA.
This is Lee Wilkins, your occasional host for Thinking Out Loud. Today we're going to talk about the universe, literally and figuratively, although actually in terms of universal things, it's really what's just in the neighborhood. I'm here in the studio with Dr. Angela Speck, the chair of the physics department at the University of Missouri, and she specializes in, among other things, astronomy. So, Angela, welcome.
Thank you.
So, there's been a lot of galaxy-wide news, I guess you could say, in the last week or so. Initially, what we wanted to talk about was the New Horizons space probe, which is just now, after many, 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 many months in transit, beginning to send us back photographs and lots of other information. And so that was the real reason for this conversation. But then overnight, we discovered that the Chinese have landed on the dark side of the moon. So if we get done with New Horizons, we'll spend a little time on the moon.
Excellent.
Okay, so Angela, tell us first of all, why is New Horizons important in a scientific sense?
So New Horizons is something that we've sent probes out into space for a long time now. We've been doing it for about 40, 50 years. And this one has taken us to bodies that we've never managed to see before up close in detail. And all knowledge is important. Whenever we send missions out, we learn new things about how the universe works. This one in particular is looking at the Kuiper Belt, which is kind of like the asteroid belt, but it's further away. It's out past Neptune. Pluto is the first of those objects that we have found. But we're able to explore not just Pluto and its moons, but then these other objects as well.
So the initial asteroid belt is the one that's sort of in the region of Mars, right? That's kind of the first one we would encounter.
So there's an asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And actually, you can think of it as being, it's a place where there might have been a planet, but the gravitational pulls of the other planets meant that one didn't form. So we just have the debris left from where one didn't form. That's the asteroid belt. Then there's another belt that's kind of like that, but it's much bigger in terms of both how wide it is. So, you know, you can think of it as being a bit like a donut around the solar system. So it's both thicker in terms of how wide the band is, but also deeper in terms of how high and low above the plane of the planets it is. And that's where there's all these bodies. They get smaller than they do in the asteroid belt, and they're very icy.
And so why, I mean, other than that, why is that important to us? What do physicists and astronomers sort of hope to learn from all of this?
So one of the things that still remains mysterious is how planets form. You know, one of the things that humanity has always been interested in is our origins. Whether it's from a religious point of view or a scientific point of view, we want to know where we come from. And one of the steps along the way is building a solar system. It used to be that we thought that our solar system was typical, but in the last 20 years since we started discovering planets around other stars, technically they're not planets, they're exoplanets, then we've realized that actually our solar system is not typical. It's quite different. And we don't know exactly. We've got ideas. We've got some hypotheses that kind of work for how it fits together, but we don't have it all figured out. And so being able to probe places like Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, that allows us to test some of the ideas we already have and maybe develop some new ideas about how the solar system came into being.
So I know if you're just the average person that the photographs that are coming back take about, I think it's something like 8 minutes to get from wherever New Horizons is at that point all the way to Earth. Is that about right? That's how long the light
travels? Oh, it's way, way longer.
Okay.
So it takes about 8.5 minutes for light to get from the sun to the Earth. And remember that, you know, radio signals, which is how we're sending the photographs, they travel at the speed of light. So, but the light's got to go a lot further. So the distance from the Earth to the sun is one astronomical unit. It's kind of the definition of an astronomical unit is that distance. So that's one astronomical unit. The distance to Pluto at its closest point is about 30 times further away, so it takes 30 times longer. It's another billion miles or so out to where the body is that it's just gone past. And in that case, it's going to take about 6 hours. If you think about how many more times 8 minutes it's got to go, it takes about six to eight hours, depending on exactly where it is.
So in some senses, the images that NASA's receiving now actually were taken, a quarter of a day, half a day, sometimes a lot longer than that.
That's right. So one of the things that I think people didn't understand when there was a party on New Year's Eve, and here in Central Time, it was right before the New Year. It was actually just after where they were on the East Coast. But they're showing this, and it was the countdown to the actual time that the probe was passing, not the time we would receive the images. So we received the images, you know, the next day in the morning. So we did get them. So it really did go past on January 1st. Both from the point of view of East Coast time, and astronomers use universal time, which is actually Greenwich Mean Time, more or less. So it really did go past on January 1st, but we couldn't see it for another 6 or so hours.
So you said that we're looking to confirm some theories and to maybe find some new ways of looking at this. What are some of the theories that you think we might be able to put to the test with the information that we're now getting from New Horizons?
So one of the common ideas about how we form planets is that you start from this big cloud of gas, and as the gas cools down, you get things forming solids. You can think of it as being, you know, if you've got dry ice, that's solid and it evaporates, but you go the other way. As it gets cold, you make it into solid things. So you're making these solids, and then they start to clump together. It's kind of like dust bunnies, but then you end up with something that's more like a pebble, and then they start to clump together, and then you've got something that's more like a boulder. And so what we want to see is, what evidence is there that that's really what's going on? And actually, it really looks like we're seeing really big boulders stuck together. If we look at the first image that was sent back of MU69, it's got this snowman shape. It's like two boulders stuck together. Now, one of them is about 20 miles across and the other one about 10. But you can think of that as being these big boulders that have collided and stuck. And so that's helping us to understand, okay, what happens during this process of building up to having something big enough to be a planet.
And I'm assuming that there are just a few other things going on here, like maybe gravity and a few other forces that are at work.
So you've got different things going on. So you can imagine that you've got two boulders that are going to hit each other. They're going to be attracted to each other by gravity, but they're also moving because they're in orbit. And so as they hit, if they're moving very fast relative to each other, they might actually obliterate each other instead of stick. If they're moving too slow, they might not catch up. And so it's kind of allowing us to look at, well, here's something that's stuck together. What were the parameters that allowed that to happen?
So you said that in some senses, our solar system is not, at least as we think we understand it now, is not typical. How is it that we're not typical? I mean, we always, I think, for human history have been very Earth, if not human-centric. So what is it that's, if not unique, at least kind of different about where we live as opposed to the other exoplanets that are now being discovered?
So some of the things that have been really weird in terms of exoplanets is the first ones to be found were what called hot Jupiters. And if we think about how we think where Jupiter, you know, Jupiter is far enough away, it's very cold. It's well below the freezing point of water. And our processes that we think about for how it got like that fit with it being formed at some distance from the sun. But we look at these other stars and they have these exoplanets that are like Jupiter, but they're very close. Now, there's a little bit of an observation bias. What I mean is that because of the way we detect planets around other stars, we are always going to find the biggest ones and the closest ones in first. You can think of it as being, there are two ways we do it. One is by looking at how much the planets pull on the star itself, so it wobbles. Even the sun wobbles because of where the planets are. So it isn't actually directly the center. The center of gravity, if all the planets were on one side, the center of gravity would be outside the sun.
Okay.
Right? And so as the planets move around, the sun wobbles. And so we can measure that. But the closer, if you have something that's close and massive, you're going to have a bigger wobble. Right? So that's easiest to detect. So those are the first things that we find. The other way is like an eclipse. So as a planet goes in front of a star, so I don't know how many people remember the transit of Venus in 2012, but you could see Venus moving in front of the sun. If the light goes down by enough, so like during the eclipse, the moon blocked out all of the sun, it gets darker. We can measure that around other stars, and that gives us a measure of how big a planet is because it's how much light it's blocking out. But again, the biggest ones are going to be easiest to detect. So the first planets that we found around other stars were all the biggest and closest to the star. And as we've gone on, we found more and more that are different from that. But we're only just really getting to the point of finding lots of things that are more like Earth.
Okay, I was going to say, so my understanding, which is, I think, dates now back to elementary school, is that Earth is not, and even in our solar system, is not a particularly big planet. So if all we're looking for, or are we able to detect, is the bigger ones first, we're not going to find a lot of planets that are similar to Earth.
Right, and then you've got the idea of Earth versus Venus. From a purely just sort of how big the planet is point of view, they're very similar. They're about the same size. But Venus is just enough closer that it's hotter, and that changes the chemistry that happens, that changes how its atmosphere behaves, and so it's not hospitable. So you could have something that's like Earth, but if it's not at the right distance from its star, its temperature won't be right. And so when we think of Earth-like, we think of something that could sustain life in the way we believe it is on Earth. And so that's it's very constrained. It can only be a certain temperature or a range of temperatures.
So New Horizons is not introducing us to Earth-like planets at all. It's introducing us to maybe what the very beginnings of Earth might have been like, or something entirely different, or we just, quite frankly, don't know.
It's all of the above. I mean, so basically it's about, we think that all planets were built in this sort of way of being able to agglomerate boulders into bigger things. And so it's allowing us to test some of those ideas. But it's also looking at the stuff that will be left behind when the sun dies, because when the sun dies, it will become a red giant. And so that's allowing us to look at, well, what's happening around other stars and what does that mean for the universe as a whole? So that there are many questions that we can answer as a result of data that we get from New Horizons.
So as someone who teaches this stuff to college students, but I think many Americans, I'm going to assume our listeners have figured out that your initial education was perhaps not in the U.S. Many Americans get introduced to this in elementary school, which is, I think, for many of us, where it gets to be exciting just to think about the solar system and you know, what might be out there and what might not, and how we all might be able to interact or at least understand it. So can you take this sort of from the college classroom, and when I send my kid off to second grade or third grade, how does what we're finding out now change what that child is going to understand about life as we sort of understand it in the 21st century?
So I think at the basic level of, you know, what is the form of the solar system, we can get into whether or not Pluto is a planet, which,
that's,
you know,
very important to some of us.
Right. But really, that's just a matter of classification. You can think of it as being there are solid bodies in the solar system that range from dust grains to huge planets. And at some point, it's useful to break them up into groups. And you can kind of think of it as being like, you know, I want to buy a dress and my dress size depends on my size. And that doesn't mean that it's intrinsically different than somebody else's dress, but it's helpful to break it up that way.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so we're breaking things up because it helps us to understand them. So Pluto being a Kuiper belt object or dwarf planet helps us to understand, okay, there really is this continuum of things. And Pluto is like at the big end of the things that aren't quite planets. And then you've got something like MU69, which is the thing we've just flown past. And that is, you know, more primitive. It's something that isn't as big, hasn't had the same activity going on. And so it's allowing us to understand that better. From the point of view of what happens in an elementary classroom, I think it will introduce people to the idea that there's a second asteroid belt. I think that's something that still really hasn't caught on. Even though we've known about the Kuiper belt was put forward as an idea, you know, 50, 60 years ago. It was, and we didn't realize that Pluto was like the first one that we found. But it's only in the last 20 years that we've really realized that this is normal, that there are lots of these bodies. And I think we're now at the point where it will become normal that there's, okay, so there's this asteroid belt and there are dwarf planets in that. And now there's this other asteroid belt and it's a bit different and there are dwarf planets in that. So I think that's where it'll go.
And as New Horizons continues to fly out there, do we have any idea what's sort of out beyond what we've either speculated about or have some evidence about at this point?
So actually where Ultima Thule is, so like I said, you can think of the Kuiper Belt as being kind of like a donut, right? It's fairly thick. So the asteroid belt might be one AU thick, so about the same distance of the Earth to the Sun, whereas we're talking about 20 or 30 AU thick for the Kuiper Belt. And Pluto is more or less at the inner edge, or at least it is when it's closest. Ultima Thule is only about halfway through.
So in other words, we still have a lot to explore and a lot to learn.
Right. Now, one of the things that's tricky that we need to understand is we have how we find things in space. You know, we can see some of the planets without a telescope, right? So you don't need a telescope to see them. But the smaller they are and the further away they are, the harder it is to see them. And you need bigger and bigger telescopes. Ultima Thule, Thule, we can talk about the name. We possibly should talk about the name. But that was only discovered in 2014. It was a specific strategy to be looking for what are the things that New Horizons can intercept that will be along the way. It was a deliberate campaign to find this thing. So although New Horizons is keeping going on out and it may well intersect with other things, they may be things that we haven't seen yet, because it's just getting so far away and things are so small, we just can't detect them.
So you mentioned to telescopes, and I think a lot of us, at least I do when I think about astronomy and the us, think of a telescope. But in fact, we're doing a lot of this work with computers and modeling and the human eye aided by a lot of really very sophisticated math, correct?
That's true. But it is still, I mean, one of the things, it's not just the human eye that's being helped by math, it's detectors. So you can think of it as being, you know, our eyes are not particularly sensitive in the dark, right? We're not that good at detecting light. One of the things that, so a telescope allows you to collect more light. It's concentrating that light. So you can see things further away. But it also is the detectors that you build. So think of it like, if you're old enough to remember using film cameras, you always had to have a flash indoors. You couldn't possibly take a picture indoors because the film was not sensitive enough.
Well, and even my phone still has a flash capacity.
But you don't need it most of the time.
Right.
And so, but you can think of that as being the device that is collecting the light is much more sensitive than your eye, or more sensitive than previous equipment. And so where we have basically things like a camera that's a digital camera, but attached to a telescope and made even more sensitive so that we can collect even a few photons that we would never see directly.
So you mentioned earlier, we maybe should talk about the name. So let's do that a bit, because I think naming objects in the solar system and beyond is really, I mean, I know most of them have numbers, but I would like for them to have personalities. So talk a little bit about this whole naming thing.
Okay, so there's actually some controversy here. So we can dig into that a little. So, you know, there is a convention, and obviously there's a lot of history. The first six planets out to Saturn, you can see without a telescope. So the naming has kind of evolved because it has this long history. At this point, the only body that can formally name any astronomical object is the International Astronomical Union. And names are put forward and there's a vetting process. So in fact, the official name of the object known as Ultima Thule is either 2014 MU69, which is to do with, you know, we always have a name for these sorts of objects, or it's Minor Planet Catalog, MPC, and then a phone number. And honestly, for most of us who are astronomers, we will use those sorts of names more than we'll use the common names. So, for instance, Betelgeuse is going to be referred to as Alpha Ori, the brightest star in Orion. Likewise, Antares is Alpha Scorpio. It's the brightest star in Scorpio. They all have a bunch of other names that are related to where they are in the sky, all those things. And so, and if you ever buy a star name, we will never use that. Just so you know. Now,
I'm
in
sure
this,
that's just crushed.
But there's also, you know, so there's also sort of a nickname that comes along. So, for instance, one of the bodies that was found out near Pluto, right around the time that Pluto was losing its planet status and becoming a dwarf planet, is currently called Eris, which is its official name. But it was briefly called Xena. And that was a nickname after Xena, warrior princess. That was a nickname given to it by the people who discovered it. And that was easier than the phone number that it has, right? So, and that's what Ultima Thule is. It is not an official name. It is a nickname that has been given. Now, the reason it's been given that name is that, you know, it's Latin, but it's coming from this idea of beyond the furthest point. That's what it literally means. And so it's an idea that this is a thing that's beyond our the place that we've got to so far. This is beyond us. And so that's a nice idea. The problem is that the idea of Ultima Thule, and specifically that terminology, was adopted by the Thule Society, which was a precursor to the Nazi movement. And so the Ultima Thule in Nazi mythology is the origin of the Aryan race. And so there is actually potentially a problem with using that term, and which is why I would prefer to call it MU69 for right now. Because, you know, it's like, oh, but it's just a name. Well, you know what? That we can say that of a lot of things. There are a lot of words that have that can bring damage. And it's not a good message to send to the world that, well, you know, the Nazis used this, but we're okay with that. It's okay if we're going to say, we're reclaiming this. We don't want this word associated with that movement. We want it associated with discovery. That's great. But that hasn't been said.
Okay. I was going to say, names have power. So we've made occasional references during this conversation to pop culture tie-ins of astronomy, whatever. But New Horizons has a very specific one, which I think you're probably aware of. So you want to clue the rest of the audience in? No? So my understanding is that one of the band members in... Okay, now we go.
Okay, so, yeah. So, well, I think it's something that... I don't know how many people realize this, but Brian May of Queen has a PhD in astrophysics. So he was a graduate student, and he actually left his program because Queen became so popular and they were huge. And it was only, it's probably actually about 20 years ago now, but it's only in the last couple of decades that he went back and got his PhD. And in fact, the work that he did in his research was on dust in the solar system, which relates to exactly the stuff that we've been talking about. It's the small particles that are floating around in the solar system. And so he wrote a piece that was premiered at the party on New Year's Eve that is for New Horizons. Unsurprisingly, it sounds like a Queen song.
Yes, and folks, I think we're going to end the segment today with just a few seconds of that song because you can pick it up off the internet. In the time we have left, talk to us a little bit about why the Chinese landing on the dark side of the moon is so important and kind of what science hopes to get from that, if you would.
So, you know, it's interesting that we've got images and we've got probes out in deep space, but actually there are things we don't understand about our own neighborhood. And the moon is one of those things. And part of the thing with the moon is we always see the same face of the moon. And this is actually, it's understood very well that we get what's called tidal locking. So basically the time it takes the moon to spin on its axis is the same time it takes to orbit the Earth. So we only ever see one face. But what that means is that we can never look directly at the other side. It also means it's difficult to communicate from the other side. Think about it in terms of, you know, now we think about calling the other side of the world and it's easy, but that's because we have satellites. It's very hard to communicate from the other side if you don't have satellites. And so even doing moon landings, it was important to land on the side pointing towards us so that we could communicate, right? And so we've never landed there. Now, we do have images because we've sent probes. So we've got things that orbit the moon. We've got images of what the far side of the moon looks like, but we've never landed there. And it actually looks quite different. You know, if you look at an image of the moon from the other side, you'd think it was Mercury. It looks much more like that. It's much more cratered. It's much more even in the way that it's covered in little pockmarks and things. And so being able to actually sample that directly and work out what's there, that's really important.
Okay. We're about out of time, so I want to, again, thank Dr. Angela Speck for coming and spending a little time with us and talking about what's in the neighborhood and what's not in the neighborhood and whether or not Pluto really is a planet and all of the rest of those things. So this is your host, Lee Wilkins, for Thinking Out Loud.
And good stuff there from Lee Wilkins and Angela Speck. It's Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. Before we close out tonight, a quick reminder that KBIA has a special event planned tomorrow night. We welcome you to Cafe Berlin for a conversation with our program Missouri Health Talks from KBIA News. Missouri Health Talks travels the state for conversations about healthcare access. And that topic, of course, has countless stories from countless angles. And tomorrow night specifically, our Rebecca Smith and her guests are going to be talking about organ donation, about how being a recipient or a donor works from a healthcare access standpoint, and some of the personal stories of those who have given organs and those who have received organs. That ought to be a very interesting conversation. Again, that's going to be happening at Cafe Berlin tomorrow night, starting at 6 o'clock, probably right until about 8:30 or so. There will be food and a cash bar there, and we will hear people talk about the challenges and triumphs around organ donation, and you'll have the opportunity to take part in that conversation. And again, that's happening tomorrow night, 6 until 8:30 at Cafe Berlin here in Columbia with Missouri Health Talks and KBIA. And that is our program for this evening, Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. A reminder that you can hear past programs in the Thinking Out Loud series. Just go to our website, kbia.org. You can click on Programs. There's a tab up at the very top of the screen, Programs for Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. We've got some fairly recent conversations, and we've got some from way in the past that we have brought back for you on the website. Just go to KBIA.org again, click on Programs for Thinking Out Loud. We have a Thinking Out Loud Facebook page. Go to Facebook and look for KBIA, Thinking Out Loud. Remember to put the KBIA in there. There's a lot of different things that say Thinking Out Loud on Facebook and kind of get lost in the rabbit hole there if you're not careful. And I am also on Twitter at KBIA Morning. And that is our program for this evening, Thinking Out Loud on 91.3 FM. Our thanks once again to our guest, Angela Speck from the MU Physics Department, the astronomy chair here on the MU campus. We're back next Tuesday evening with another Thinking Out Loud here on 91.3 FM. Till then, for my co-host Lee Wilkins, I'm Darren Hellwedge. Have a great evening. Thank you.